Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the broadcast today, the business news that did not happen will explain exactly how they figure out what a living wage is. Here's a hint. It has to do with MIT and the CEO of Yelp as well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday, August the 6th. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. This might well be called the business news cycle where things unhappened. Late yesterday, it was Rupert Murdoch giving up on Time Warner, as we told you. Today, it's Sprint giving up on T-Mobile and Walgreens, the drugstore chain, deciding not to move overseas. Corporate inversion is the term of art you've been hearing for when an American company merges with or outright buys a company abroad, preferably in places where taxes are lower than they are here, and then moves. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour gets us going.
When Walgreens started to buy out a British firm 2 years ago, it wasn't planning on doing an inversion.
Our situation was very different from a lot of the other companies you've heard about.
Michael Polzin is a spokesman for Walgreens. Somewhere along the way, Walgreens thought maybe they could use this as a way to relocate, invert. But it turned out that legally, it was like hammering a square peg into a round hole.
We'd have to basically rip up that deal and come up with a new deal.
Walgreens is also different in another way. People have heard of it. Ross Muchen is a senior managing director at ISI Group.
If AbbVie or Covidien leave the United States, no one knows those brands as a consumer, but most people will know Walgreens.
Consumers could be turned off if the Walgreens they knew skipped town for tax reasons. So would this guy.
My attitude is I don't care if it's legal, it's wrong.
President Obama and legislators have taken aim at corporate inverters, and Walgreens gets between a quarter and a third of its business from the government through Medicare and Medicaid. Uncle Sam is a customer it would rather not antagonize. But most companies considering an inversion don't have these concerns. Most companies are not Walgreens.
We will see significant inversions over the next couple years.
Dick Harvey is a professor at the Villanova School of Law. While everyone waits for comprehensive tax reform, the Treasury announced it would try to close some inversion tax loopholes on its own, but
they clearly would not stop all inversions.
Harvey says the benefits of relocating outside the U.S., lower taxes, access to cash, freedom to move money, are, for now, still just too good. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
We are plus or minus halfway through the ceasefire in Gaza. What are being called indirect talks are underway between Palestinian and Israeli officials in Cairo about what's going to happen when the thing is due to expire and perhaps also opening up Gaza's borders, borders that have been more or less sealed to trade and to people by both Israel and Egypt since Hamas came to power in Gaza back in 2007. Repairing the physical damage that has been done will obviously cost billions of dollars. But beyond that, is there an economy that can be built in Gaza? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has a look at that.
This morning, all Israeli ground forces withdrawing from the Gaza Strip. Both Israel and Hamas.
As the ceasefire began, damage estimates rolled in. $4 billion, maybe $6 billion, will be needed from international donors to rebuild homes and the main power plant, get olive farms and small workshops going again.
Even if you bring in $5 billion, $6 billion, $8, $9 billion, all that that's going to do is just replace what they had, put them where they were.
University of Maryland Middle East expert Shibli Telhami.
We know where they were was an awful place. Some people were calling it an open prison.
Since 2007, when Hamas took over, Israel has kept all but a trickle of humanitarian supplies and people from crossing the border. No concrete to build inside. Israel says it could be used for military purposes. No produce or furniture to sell outside, except what's smuggled through tunnels.
There's no economy in Gaza. You can't export from the Gaza Strip.
Khaled El-Gindi at the Brookings Institution explains there's virtually no industry or services that can bring in capital, which is why two-thirds of the population lives on international aid. So what's needed to get an economy started?
It would make a huge difference in terms of normalizing Gaza to have a seaport.
And an airport. Shibli Telhami says if Palestinians controlled their own seacoast and airspace.
It does have a waterfront. In good time, if they ever come, could be turned into relatively inexpensive vacation spots.
And, says Leila Hilal at the New America Foundation,
the Gazans are very enterprising. They've been surviving under total isolation.
She points out the population is young and educated. The Palestinian diaspora could help with expertise and investment dollars, but she says a political opening and open borders need to come first. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, so flat they might as well have taken the day off. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's going to be a vote tomorrow in Indianapolis, Indiana, that may well change college athletics as we know them. The NCAA Division I Board of Directors is going to decide whether to give schools in the five richest athletic conferences, the Big Five, they're called, the SEC, the Big Ten, the ACC, the Big 12, and the Pac-12, whether to give them more independence and, more to our point, more power to let the actual athletes share in the spoils. That is, get the students more money. Mark Tracy covers college sports for the New York Times. He wrote the story in the paper today. Mark, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So if this vote does go the way that these bigger schools want, maybe it's just me, but it kind of seems like it's the rich getting richer.
It certainly is. And first, I should say that while we obviously don't know how exactly the vote will go, everyone I spoke to expects it to pass in one way or another. So but the other part of the equation is important, too, which is that they're already the rich. Their facilities are wonderful. They have the programs. They have resources that do make their way, if not directly to the students, at least to the general student and athletic experience. And the new model is as much a recognition of that fact on the part of the NCAA.
It's codifying reality, then.
It's exactly what it is.
The president of the NCAA, Mark Emmert, has been in favor of some of these reforms along some of these lines. I'm guessing this all is happening with his blessing.
Yes, I think that's – I mean, they're not giving an explicit comment, but I think that is safe to say. He pushed for stipends 3 years ago. He's been the chief executive at two different Big Five universities, Washington and Louisiana State. Yeah. But he's even said things like he's concerned about conference realignment, which isn't on the table for this. In fact, conference realignment is part of the reason this happened. He's kind of faced with a choice, which is that you have these conferences. They have the valuable – television deals for football, not the NCAA. So they have a ton of money and a ton of power, and the commissioners, particularly the commissioners of the Big Ten and the SEC, they've been threatening to take their balls and go home, or rather, to a new place.
What happens, though, if this vote goes against the Big Five schools? Could they conceivably say, you know what, we are big enough and powerful enough, and we are going to do it on our own. Television networks will pay us bazillions of dollars to see our teams on television.
So they certainly have threatened as much. How feasible that is, I mean, I'm not sure anyone really knows, but it's the so-called Division Four, although really it's more like a Division Zero, since it would be above
it
even
be
Division
above,
One.
Yeah,
it's
the best schools. They need to get their nomenclature right.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, these schools are excellent in many sports, and above all football, which is above all the money driver. They might be concerned that something's being lost. President Emmert argues that college sports' amateur aspect and ties to the colleges are part of what makes them so popular, and that if you did this, you know, maybe you would diminish that. So those would be some of the potential drawbacks.
Yeah. If I'm a smaller sport athlete at a non-Big Five school, how much am I worried about this? Am I going to worry about losing my funding? Am I going to worry about being shut down conceivably?
It's possible. I think certainly in some of the so-called non-revenue sports, which, you know, operate at a loss, you could be concerned about that, because if you're a non-Big Five school that nonetheless feels it needs to compete with the Big Five schools and offer more to students, say, in football, then you might need to cut costs elsewhere, whether that's about cutting costs generally because you don't have the budget, whether that's about, you know, following Title IX, the civil rights law that requires substantially proportionate funding between men's and women's sports. Those are a bunch of unknowns. Will that actually be something that happens? I don't know. It's certainly possible.
Yeah. Mark Tracy covers college sports for the New York Times. Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up,
It doesn't really matter about your location. It doesn't matter whether you're spending millions of dollars on advertising. What really matters is your product or service.
How the CEO of Yelp might rate his own business. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. The Dow Industrial is up 13 points today. A 10th percent ended at 16,443, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ put on 2 points, not even really worth it percentage-wise, closed at 4355. The S&P 500 rose just a tad. We'll call it steady, really, at 1920. Time Warner unplugged almost 13% after 21st Century Fox dropped its takeover bid, as we were mentioning. Fox snapped up more than 3% on that news. Sprint uncoiled 19% today after canceling its takeover of T-Mobile. T-Mobile shares fell 8%. Walgreens dispensed with 14% on the news. There will be no corporate inversion. Molson Coors tapped a gain of 6% today. Global beer sales are down, but prices have risen. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.47%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to issue consumer credit data for June. Chain stores are slated to report sales for July. And the U.S. Postal Service issues new forever stamps featuring baked goods, produce, flowers, and plants. All products you might find at a farmer's market. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. This was a whiz-bang day on Wall Street for the electric car maker Tesla, up about 4.3%. The company announced this morning it has resolved the trademark dispute over in China, that is to say, over in the world's biggest car market, with a guy who registered Tesla as a trademark before the company did. So there's that. Also, the company has started work on a huge new battery factory in Reno, Nevada. But capitalism being capitalism, that doesn't necessarily mean Reno's going to actually get the factory and its 6,500 jobs when all is said and done. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
Breaking ground just doesn't mean what it used to. Tesla started building in Reno, knowing all along its new gigafactory might not actually be completed there. On a recent earnings call, CEO Elon Musk said he might do similar construction on one or two other sites, maybe Arizona, California, New Mexico, or Texas.
On the Nevada side, at this point, the ball is in the court of the governor and the state legislature.
Tesla says it's worth some duplicate construction costs to get the factory up and running ASAP. But the carmaker also wants the host state to chip in 10% of the $4 or $5 billion the plant will cost. And if Reno won't ante up, Tim Bardick is an economist at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. He says shopping around for a good deal from states isn't unusual, but
it's pretty unusual for them to be actually starting construction on a site.
And Bardick says states should approach these types of deals with caution.
Incentives are not a free lunch. They do involve costly resources.
So local officials need to analyze what wages the company will pay or the suppliers it might work with. Josh Goodman researches tax incentives for Pew Charitable Trusts.
Until recently, most states weren't doing this kind of analysis. And sometimes, you know, they might do the analysis on a program that was getting attention because there was a lot of problems there.
But many states are wising up, Goodman says, passing laws and requiring reviews of their incentives to be sure their development dollars actually pay for meaningful development. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The Swedish furniture store IKEA made some news not too long ago. It said it's going to start using a new and higher pay structure for its American workers. That is a not small thing from the world's largest furniture retailer. But there was a footnote in the announcement that caught the eye of our Chrissy Clark over on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. The company said its lowest wages will be based on something called the MIT Living Wage Calculator. Here's Chrissy with that story.
Amy Glassmeyer is the kind of person who, when she goes on a trip somewhere, rather than driving around to see famous landmarks or tourist attractions for fun, she does this.
I drive around and figure out what it costs to live there.
Squints at prices on store shelves, cruises past apartments with for rent signs to see how much they're going for. Glassmeyer is a professor of geography and regional planning at MIT, and this travel hobby of hers has to do with a question that's always interested her. Why do certain places have such high poverty rates when others don't? In her travels, in her research, she's found that high poverty places are often ones where lots of the available jobs pay minimum wage, a wage that
absolutely was not paying people enough to live on.
So what would be enough to live on? That would, of course, depend on where someone lived and how much it costs. And so Glassmeyer rounded up some of her best grad students to create basically a giant spreadsheet and loaded it up with the best regional data available from government and industry surveys.
Housing, food, childcare, medical expenses, transportation.
The spreadsheet adds all these costs up, adjusts for household size, divides by the number of hours typically worked in a year, and ta-da! The MIT Living Wage Calculator was born. Go to the website, type in your city.
Come up with what's called a living wage.
This is not a middle-class wage, cautions Glassmeyer. It would not cover a trip to Hawaii once a year or savings for retirement. Just enough to pay bills for the bare-bones necessities of life and not fall behind. Since Glassmeyer created the calculator, it's had some fans, policy wonks, unions, the occasional small business owner, but it was a relatively obscure tool until one day a few weeks ago when
I got a phone call from a person in the press.
A reporter saying that IKEA was planning to use it to set its own internal minimum wage.
We truly do see it as the right thing to do.
Rob Olson is the acting president for IKEA US.
We see this as an opportunity to increase coworker loyalty, decrease turnover, being able to attract more and more qualified applicants.
Olson says it would be too complicated to pay people different wages based on different household sizes. So IKEA's going to stick with what the living wage calculator comes up with for a single person with no children. In other words, the lowest possible living wage. Still, starting in January, the minimum pay for an IKEA worker in an expensive suburb of D.C. will be more than $13 an hour. Over in Pittsburgh, where cost of living is lower, it'll be $8.29. Even so, a dollar more than federal minimum wage. I asked Olson how IKEA found out about the MIT Living Wage Calculator, and he told me
consultants.
He didn't know much about who was behind the actual tool. And Amy Glassmeyer, the professor who is behind it, is fine with that. With all the political debates over where to set the minimum wage right now,
I think the anonymity in some funny way actually makes people feel better, as if it was just an MIT robot somewhere in a closet crunching the numbers on a daily basis, right? That's the picture.
Of course, the MIT Living Wage Calculator is not a number-crunching robot in a closet, but the objectivity that the name suggests does seem to make it more attractive to businesses, large and small.
Can I check that bread, please?
At a Jimmy John's sandwich shop in Peru, Illinois, the franchise owner, a guy named Art Rietwald, is helping his workers get the next batch of bread out of the oven. Rietwald used to pay all his employees minimum wage. Then, one day, a few years ago, a worker mentioned he was looking for a second job because he couldn't make ends meet.
It's very difficult knowing that you have a good living for yourself and working right next to somebody every day who's trying very hard. And they're helping you grow that business. And knowing that they can't survive the bumps that come up in life, an employer always has to make the decision between, you know, how much is too much for me at the expense of them.
Rietwald says when he found the living wage calculator one night doing research on Google, it felt like a relief.
Part of why I like the living wage calculator, it is, as far as I can tell, political free. It is actual data.
And yet, as politics-free and data-driven as the calculator may be, it's still made by humans who have to choose the data, update it, and on a professor's research budget, that can only happen so often. The data for Illinois, where Jimmy John's sandwich shop is, and every other state, is from a few years ago, meaning it doesn't reflect recent rises in the cost of living. In fact, after IKEA announced it was going to be using the living wage calculator, Professor Glassmeyer emailed them to thank them for raising the wages.
But then I also told them that we were going to have an update, and the update was going to have a wage that was going to be higher than the one they were using.
IKEA says for now it's sticking with the older, lower calculations, but that annually they'll reevaluate. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
If you've ever been out on a Saturday night looking for a place to have dinner, or maybe you need to get the screen on your iPhone replaced, or, what, a pair of shoes fixed, maybe, you've probably used Yelp, the online reviews website and app. In fact, it's kind of hard to remember digital life without it. The company's been around for a decade, 10 years this week, in fact. So today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Jeremy Stoppelman, the CEO and co-founder of Yelp. Jeremy, thanks for coming on.
Great to be here.
10 years, man, is a long time to be doing something in Web 2.0. Are you feeling that now?
You know, time flies when you're having fun. And I can't believe that 10 years has already rolled around. Feels like it's just been maybe 3 or 4.
One does have to say that making money helps time fly, yes?
And we just turned a profit.
I know,
so that's a nice thing. But, we've been building this thing for a long time. And really, it's all been about the content and the community and growing traffic. And now, it's a real business.
Who are your customers, though? Is it the people who, on a Saturday, who need to find brunch, go to Yelp? Or is it the restaurant that provides them the brunch?
We have a few different constituencies. One is obviously the Yelp community, the people that contribute all these great reviews. And they overlap, of course, with the consumers, the people that are finding all these places to spend their hard-earned money. And then, of course, there's the business owners that benefit from all this word of mouth getting broadcast online and consumers ultimately finding them. And so we're trying to balance across all of the constituencies to make sure that Yelp is a great resource for finding the best local businesses.
We will surely, though, get calls and letters from small business people after this interview airs, and they will say that they are hostage to Yelp, that they can be brutalized by a couple of bad reviews and business goes down the toilet. What's your response?
If you think about the world prior to Yelp, it was a world of the professional critic. And so that meant lots of businesses didn't get any exposure at all. And the ones that did had kind of a one-shot deal where, there was a supposed expert that would come a few times to the restaurant, and then that's the reputation of the restaurant. And the beauty of Yelp is that it's now this concert of opinions. And so every day there's new customers coming in and there's new opportunities to give them a great experience and then earn yourself a great review.
Doesn't sound very sympathetic. It's kind of like, we're here, get over it.
I mean, it's a very democratic way, I would say, to find and pick local businesses. And so I think it's created a really level playing field. And so it doesn't really matter about your location. It doesn't matter whether you're spending millions of dollars on advertising. What really matters is your product or service, which I think is great for consumers and ultimately great for business owners.
Where, by the way, did the name Yelp come from? Who thought of that?
So back in the early days, we were basically in an incubator, and there was a guy we were working with, David, and he just came up with the name. He said it was, like Help Yelp or Yelp Yellow Pages, and both my and Russ's initial response was, ooh,
yeah.
I don't know, that's kind of a negative word. but we slept on it, and the next day it was kind of history. We decided to go with it.
What was it like that day that you decided not to sell your company to Google for many, many hundreds of millions of dollars?
I guess you could call it lonely. So when you're in that type of situation where you're staring down a very high dollar offer for essentially your baby, a company that you built over a period of many years, it's difficult. But at the same time, you see the potential. And you have to kind of weigh the pros and cons and try to predict the future. And in our case, and I think fortunately, we chose the independent path and the company is much more successful as a result.
Is it true that as you were negotiating around a venture financing after you decided not to sell the company, Steve Jobs called? Is that a true story?
That is a true story.
What do you say?
I was literally negotiating our newest round of financing. And, our office manager assistant, came dramatically into the meeting where we were having interrupting the phone call and slipped me a piece of paper that said Steve Jobs is on the line. And I immediately became very nervous. I think I was shaking probably a little bit. And I ran out and I'm like, what is this about? She's like, no, seriously, Steve Jobs is on the line. And so it got transferred to my phone. And sure enough, it wasn't Steve Jobs, but Steve Jobs' assistant was waiting on the line.
Hold for Mr. Jobs, please.
And then I was given the please hold for Steve Jobs, and he appeared.
And what did he say?
You know, he expressed his support of the company, which, you know, we already had some idea of that. Apple had put us in some commercials, you know, because we had an app in the App Store very early on and it was quite successful. And so he reiterated that he was a fan of the company. And then he also made sure to tell us he didn't think it was a great idea to sell to Google.
Jeremy Stoppelman is the co-founder and CEO at Yelp. Jeremy, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today. You remember that picture that was floating around the internet a while ago? The one a monkey had taken of herself using a camera that it had liberated from a British wildlife photographer. Basically, it was a monkey selfie. If you don't remember it, we've got it, I think, on our website. It's marketplace.org. Anyway, the Telegraph newspaper over in the UK reports today that Wikipedia has declined the photographer's request to stop distributing that picture without his permission because, Wikipedia says, the monkey pushed the shutter button and so it owns the copyright. So there you go. There's a PhD thesis in copyright law in there somewhere. All right, we're done. The Dow added 13 points today, a 10%. The NASDAQ put on 2 points, a fractional gain. The S&P 500 ended right where it started. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.